fly.
Welcome back to UBC Insiders On Air. It's the week of January 22nd, 2016. Yep, 2016, and we are glad to be back in the studio after a bit of a break. As you know, we're the show that brings you opinions, interviews, analysis, and the best informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You are listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. My name is Mayan Kreitzman.
And I'm Neil Janssen. We say this every week, but it's true. You can and should check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for detailed stories on some of what we talk about on the air. For example, this week, I discuss the overblown expectations in the search for the new UBC president. And of course, there's an awesome archive full of 9 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
So notice how I've updated the script to now say 9 years. We've got a great show for you today. We'll catch up on news from over the break and play some audio from the presidential search town hall that happened last week. And as a sort of tradition, since we had him on for our very first show, we thought we would have AMS President Aaron Bailey back for this, our first episode of 2016. We'll be finding out if he's declaring victory in the fight over international tuition increases and looking ahead to the AMS elections.
To start things off this week, we're talking about the UBC presidential search. As we all know, Martha Piper is filling in as president for a one-year term after Arvind Gupta's dramatic departure this past summer, and a presidential search committee has been convened and hired an executive search firm to help out. We had trouble staying completely away from radio pursuits over the break, and so put in an appearance at the presidential search town hall, which took place last Tuesday in the Alumni Center. It was an open town hall where anyone could speak, and the whole search committee was there to listen and take notes. The voices you're about to hear are mostly staff and faculty members, and while we're not including their names, you'll get a sense of the comments that were expressed during the meeting.
I just hope that whatever job description you give the presidential candidate, that it's clear, that it's clear what their mandate is, so that they are strong in understanding why they're walking into this job and strong in understanding what the university wants from their president. And that's the only thing I can say to that first question, because I really don't know what a president doesn't do, and I don't know what they do do.
What I see as perhaps a challenge for the new president, for the university as a whole, is to remember to support the value of the humanities in post-secondary education. I think, I know after the recent federal election, there was a great internet meme going around with a picture of Justin Trudeau saying, "What can you do with an English literature degree? Become Prime Minister of Canada." So I didn't quite make it that far, but quite happy to serve UBC in my own way.
We don't always work together as well as we could. I think from a leadership perspective, the president can bring a certain degree of leadership, but really that person needs to galvanize an awful lot of other people. And I certainly have seen missed opportunities in my time here, just with regard to bringing the right people together to chart the right vision.
A priority that I would just love to see, that is not so much to do with the search, but more or less what comes after the circumstances of the last president's departure. I know that for legal reasons, et cetera, like it's kind of a bit gray, nobody knows why, but any situation where somebody had to, or family needs to, like, walk away from the position after only a year, I guess my priority would be to make sure that the next guy doesn't have that same problem or have to feel that same pressure.
We have tenured faculty, which I think is absolutely appropriate. And there was a time when that was instituted where it was required that those faculty members retire at 65. The challenge is that faculty are tenured, but there's no requirement for them to retire. And I think that's going to drive the costs significantly at our university. And so that would be an example of where I would hope that a president would be willing to take that tough, have those tough conversations.
So I've been at UBC now for about 9 years over. In that time teaching at UBC, my class sizes have doubled. The lectures that I teach on a regular basis, I don't know my students' names. I can't. I'm in a building that is so old, the ceiling fell down in front of my office.
I'm very interested in the fact that more than a quarter of Canadian university presidencies fail. and consulting everybody. And the day they appoint the president, there's a huge tendency to sit back and assume it's all going to work out and that this new guru, he or she, is going to know how to do everything. And so I believe, and Trachtenberg in the States says the same thing, that actually there's no magic person that's best for this job. It's how you work with that person that really matters. A lot of people can do the job with the kind of support that is really needed.
So we've been listening to some tape from the town hall held by the Presidential Search Committee last week. As people were milling around and leaving, we snagged Lindsay Gordon, who's UBC's chancellor and also the chair of the search committee.
We were wondering what you thought about today's town hall.
It was very good feedback. I mean, some of the key themes that emerge. And, you know, and I must say, because just to be clear, when I emphasize that UBC is a major public research institution, research actually drives excellence in teaching, drives reputation, drives our ability to attract great faculty to teach and great students. So
you're putting research at the center of this.
Well, research is, that's what we are. Right, we are a major public research institution, and is he?
Well, I think 40,000 undergraduate students might disagree with you slightly.
Well, you see,
on that.
I would say the dilemma that the assumption is that there's some trade-off. If you do research, you can't do excellent teaching. Personally, I'd argue, and actually, I think Arvind Gupta argued the research also drives the teaching capability.
There was a question about supporting the president as they come in. And providing sort of the conditions that they can succeed, unlike in the President Gupta, of course. Do you know if the new president is going to be provided with details of that story that aren't available to the public?
No, I think as we've clearly communicated in the past, and I recognize it's very frustrating for people, we're not able to go into the details. Having said that, I think for the new leader, they will ask lots of questions of different people and get feedback. They will be, if they're true leaders, they will be used to dealing with ambiguity. And it is very unfortunate. I don't want to say anything other than to acknowledge what's happened is unfortunate. Having said that, it's not that it doesn't happen, but whether it's in the university environment, in the broader social sector, in the private sector, but true leaders, they're used to dealing with ambiguity. And to be honest, I think true leaders actually like a challenge, like to be able to kind of make their mark.
Now, the president is only one piece. It's a big piece, but only realistically one piece of the leadership and the direction and the management of the university. Of course, there's all the other executives as well as the board and the Senate. And from listening to the comments here, the way the president was described is sort of as a unicorn. Like, this person is not going to exist. No human can rise to the capabilities that everyone wants. But it strikes me as people having very good articulation of the qualities that they want to see in their leadership more generally.
Yeah, I think in terms of the key attributes that we need in the next president, first of all, those will be laid out in the position profile that will be public. The position profile actually has to be approved by the Board of Governors, so they will be very exposed to this. So absolutely. And again, just to go back to your point, the unicorn, as I said in my opening remarks, and I truly believe this is not me just talking for the sake of talking, being the president of a large public university is one of the most demanding leadership roles in society. We need to kind of understand that you can't find somebody who can do absolutely everything. There will be trade-offs, but as I've said before, I'm very confident that we will find a very excellent new president.
Okay, thank you very much to Chancellor Lindsay Gordon.
Pleasure.
The last person we talked to after the town hall is Philip Edgecombe, who's an MD-PhD student and used to be a student senator. Here's what he had to say.
I was pleased with the town hall. It was mostly an opportunity for UBC community members, of which there was a significant diversity, to share their opinions with the representatives. I would have loved to see more students there. I think we had maybe two or three students in the room out of about 100 people. One thing that I recall as a fun anecdote is that my dad was a student here himself, and President Gage used to welcome him as he was coming into class, and he says he has very fond memories about how the president would ask him how he was doing and the other students, and even taught a class at some point. And so it would be quite exciting to see a new president that was so student-focused.
Well, thanks for that anecdote, yeah. Philip.
Cheers.
So one of the voices we didn't hear there was yours, Mayan. You went up to the mic during the town hall. What did you have to say?
Yeah, I did. I was a little nervous, actually, although I usually have a pretty big mouth. I don't know. But the two points that I made were, the first one was around making explicit the political position that candidates hold around the issue of public funding versus private funding for the university. There's no right answer, but I think asking people about their politics around that ahead of time is really important. The second thing was about finding out if the president is student-oriented. There weren't that many students at the town hall, actually, which was a bit surprising. So I felt like I needed to pipe up and say something that mentioned students, because kind of nobody else was. Neil, so you didn't get up there and say anything, but you did write a post on the blog. What's that about?
Yeah, it wasn't so much aimed directly at the search committee about what I'd like to see in a new president, but more of a reflection on how futile the whole thing might be if taken at face value. And it's sort of the expectation being set up by this search committee is that we're going to find some sort of deus ex machina figure who's going to swoop in and make everything all right. And really the point I was making was that it was really should have been taken as what the university community wants to see in their leadership as a whole, which goes well beyond the president and includes Senate and governors and deans and vice presidents and all sorts of other people.
But I don't think it's really futile, Neil. You use the word futile. Like, I think it's nice to see that a lot of attention is being paid to process. I do agree that it's naive that, you know, we'll find one soulmate for UBC and live happily ever after. But a good process for hiring could potentially translate into a good process for supporting and engaging with the president and with other leadership, like you said, Neil.
Another take on this came from the Faculty Association. They released a letter publicly outlining their priorities in the search committee. They had two main points. First is that any internal candidate will inevitably come with baggage, so they would strongly suggest hiring an external candidate in order to provide a sort of blank slate to start from.
Right. And their second point was around diversity. So I'll just read out what they said. Diversity is not only a question of race, gender, or sexual orientation. Rather, it's about the coexistence of a range of beliefs and values. A new president and a new administration must be comfortable with debate and difference, capable of leading by persuasion, and tolerant of dissent. So basically they're saying that diversity shouldn't be tokenizing somebody's identity or background, but more about how the person themselves regards differences. And Neil, you've had some rumors about which internal candidates might be in the running as well.
Well, yeah, it's been rumored that Gage Averill, the current Dean of Arts, put his name forward during the last presidential search and made it reasonably far. He could be aiming for the job again, and the Faculty of Arts actually has a search ongoing for a new dean, so it might be a situation where he's tacitly asked for a big promotion or he walks.
So basically he's already looking, and he's said, I'm leaving no matter what, so look for a new dean, and this might be one of the positions he's applying for?
That's one way to interpret it, certainly. And then Nassif Ghassoub, who's been a frequent critic of the administration and especially of the board.
Who's a math professor here, by the way.
Yeah, he's been suggesting for a while that the whole thing around Gupta's resignation was engineered to have Sauder Dean Bob Helsley take the top job. But frankly, that guy is a bit of an empty suit and would be a terrible president unless the goal was to alienate even more of campus.
Okay, so moving on to some FOI issues, there's two things this week. The first one, Neil, do you want to talk about the Smith Report? Because you were involved in filing that FOI and you've written about it on the blog.
Sure. The Smith Report is the investigation into Jennifer Birdall's allegations against John Montalbano and other people in the Sauder School of Business that her academic freedom had been infringed. They had released a summary document of the report in October and said that the entire report would not be released. However, I filed a Freedom of Information request for it and was given the whole report. Unfortunately, huge sections of it were severed, grayed out, because they were supposedly infringing on people's privacy.
And the whole thing, which we discussed with Mark McLean and with Jennifer Birdall, and you can look back at our old episodes to hear those, was that in the summary report, they presented the conclusions from the findings, but they didn't say anything about who did what when. There wasn't any details about the actual occurrences that led to the interference with Jennifer Birdall's academic freedom, which was the end finding.
Yeah, and the full report gives you headings like chronology, and then it simply has 11 pages of completely blacked out material. So those details of who did what when are clearly in there, but they don't even want to give factual information like dates. What are the main dates involved? And they've completely concealed the identities of the people involved, even though it seems probable that the people were doing it in their capacity as UBC employees. So it's hardly an invasion of their personal privacy to find out about what they were doing on work time.
And so, Neil, you're going to be appealing this?
Yeah, I've asked the Office of the Information and Privacy Commissioner for review, but that process is still just getting started now.
Okay. And speaking of other FOIs that haven't been released yet, there's the Gupta FOIs, of course. There's this set of, I think, dozens of different FOIs that various media organizations filed with the university. It's been delayed now for the third time. The last date was supposed to be on the 17th, I believe.
Well, they didn't even delay. There's rules in the law where you can have formal delays, and UBC has run out of delays, and the deadline to release them has passed, and they simply said, we don't have them for you.
So what's going to happen? Like, is this another thing where people are going to appeal to the privacy commissioner?
I hope they do, because, yeah, they're not even trying to make excuses anymore. They're just saying, we're not giving them to you, and we're not going to tell you why.
But, like, what's the logical end to this? So if complaints are lodged with the privacy commissioner, and they are basically illegally not releasing the information that they've promised, what happens next?
Well, people can complain, and they can get an order against UBC, but the problem is these can be appealed forever. And so if UBC's strategy is simply to delay things, they can do that for a lot longer and kind of get away with it. Guest today is Aaron Bailey, the 106th and current president of the AMS, UBC Student Society. Aaron, you are the guest on our very first show in September, so welcome back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So there were lots of issues over the fall term. International tuition, there was some squabbling with UBC over some smaller things like a donation to the Nest and plans for the block party. But just so we don't spread ourselves too thin, we're going to focus on the presidential search and the outcome of the international tuition hike. So on the presidential search, one of the interesting points raised during the town hall is that a whole bunch of work goes into the search, but that completely ends once the name is chosen and the person is basically left to fend for themselves and solve all these problems. Do you know if there's a plan, because you're part of the search committee, on how to provide support for whoever is chosen in the first 6 months of their term or whatever?
That came out not only in the town hall, but in some other meetings and just like conversations we were having, because naturally like a lot of the topic has been around why the last presidency didn't work and what was going wrong and why, you know, all the things that happened last term happened. We haven't really gotten into it much at the search committee, partly because the time is so crunched for us to find this individual. And frankly, it's not really the responsibility of the search committee to think so much about that. But it's definitely a topic that's come up a number of times, and I think it's something the board will have to grapple with. Naturally, I think part of the characteristics we're looking for in a person is that kind of ability to adapt very quickly and get comfortable with a new situation and a setting and hopefully dive right in. But that's not to say that, you know, an individual doesn't need support, whether from, you know, it's the board or their advisory committees or from the executive themselves. But we haven't really doted too much on how we would play a role in that.
So there's the like mechanistic way that, other than the fact that it's the board's responsibility to somehow do this.
Yeah, well, it's like, I guess it would be like any other job, right? I assume there's some transition process that this individual will go through. I don't know the details of that. What those functions are, we haven't really discussed ourselves, because we're really just tasked with finding the person.
One of the things in the town hall was that there is a huge, wide diversity of opinions expressed about what the president should have. Are there any themes that you've heard that have come out of this that have been really strong in your mind or like repeated really often?
really the like leadership characteristics didn't differ too much, that like the characteristics and values themselves, you hear the natural things, right? You're going to hear empathy, you're going to hear inspiration, you're going to hear somebody who has some like knowledge of finances and can run an organization. We've heard from a lot of people, not just faculty, that they need to have some experience with academia, some people saying very extensive experience, right? So there are common themes there. I think the thing that we saw the most difference and disparity in, which was kind of expected, is the opportunities and the challenges and the things that this person is going to face. When you look at the organization, because it's so massive and so complex and we're doing a million things at once, it's natural that different facets of the institution are going to have different priorities at the top of the list.
So we should mention that you were actually moderating that town hall event, which was nice to see. But I was wondering, because, I mean, you're a student, you're the president of the AMS, so you represent us, but there weren't very many other students there. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious, did you feel like it all tokenized since there's no students involved? We're just going to put you here in the middle.
No, it makes sense a little bit, I guess, to have a student, in my opinion, as like the largest stakeholder of the university, be in the driver's seat somewhere like that. I also kind of volunteered. Again, all of us, although we're representing different groups on campus, we have to work together as a 21-person committee to find the best individual, not necessarily the best individual for our group of people, right?
And not to take away from your performance, but the role was mostly a functionary one, pointing to which mic went next.
Yeah, if somebody was going to filibuster for 20 minutes, like I probably would have had to say, okay, let's move on or do something like that. But everybody kept the time limits, and it was really just me directing the flow. And
there wasn't really any symbolism to you being up there.
I wouldn't say so.
I think that, of course, there was. I think there was symbolism. I don't know.
Like, Tom also agreed to moderate the one in the Okanagan. Mm-hmm. He's a student.
You're talking
as
about
well.
Tom McCauley, the president of the UBC SUO.
Yeah, so
maybe it's good symbolism, but I think it was a little bit there. On the student thing, have you heard from students in other ways that weren't necessarily at that event?
I know there's been a number of students who've actually responded online. They're not the vast majority. The vast majority have come from other areas of the community, alumni and faculty specifically, but there have been some students and even some parents of students who have, like, chimed in, naturally because of the media that was around the school last term. We also did have a discussion that was fairly fruitful at AMS Council last week, so we spent about 45 minutes as a big group just talking about those two questions. I did host public office hours for 2.5 hours, but nobody showed up, which is, again, not something.
I was going to bring you popcorn, but I was stuck at work.
That's okay. Somebody brought me up chocolate milk, and I was really happy about that.
Maybe we should transition from the search for the UBC president to the search for the next AMS president. Nominations for elections are open. What do you plan to run for this time around?
I'm not going to be running for an executive position, that's for sure. I have decided that this year has been a great one for me, and I've learned a lot, but I want to move on and do other things. My time as a student in this degree is coming to an end as well, so I'm graduating. I'm not ruling
out. So what you're saying is bored.
I'm not ruling out a run for the board, but since the campaign period isn't open, I'm not going to really expound upon it.
Who do you think is going to be AMS president next year?
Whoever gets the most votes in the elections, I think.
Someone must have told you that they're running by now, though.
You hear rumors, honestly. At our exec meeting this morning, we had a good discussion around the table about how we're going to do the best we can to make sure that the offices themselves are a campaign-free zone. Unless you're having a meeting with somebody and they're asking you questions about the position, I really want us to focus on spending the rest of our term doing our job.
Let's move on and talk about the other bigger topic that we wanted to get to. Sort of the AMS's battle or war around this international tuition hike. The AMS came out pretty strongly against this, but you could characterize it as a sort of won the battle, lost the war situation.
They reduced the increases by $2,000 each, but that just meant a 50% increase turned into a 40% increase, which is still quite substantial.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are your reflections on sort of the whole thing, and then maybe we'll zero in on a couple points?
I think the analogy you made is good. It's a war, right? Like, it's something that's continuous with the situation that the university faces and the inaffordability that's mounting for students. It's a continual tension there. It's a really exhausting thing to think about continuously and really put effort into, because you always kind of come to loggerheads on the argument. This year was a little different from last, and there was a lot of substantive research and work done in office on looking at the numbers and the benchmarking and really coming with a bit more logical of a proposition to the board when we actually presented.
Can you explain exactly what you mean by benchmarking? Because I know that was one of the things that you guys spent a lot of time on, and that seemed to be really effective when you presented to the board and everybody love those speeches that you and Jenna gave.
Mm-hmm. So benchmarking generally is what institutions are we pegging ourselves at and what are the numbers you're comparing to? In every single program they reviewed, they had comparator institutions, and they would then benchmark our increases over the course of the 3 years to get up to that level. We found, and Jenna really is the one I need to give credit to because her and her team did the most work on the science behind it, found tons of flaws and inconsistencies with their benchmarking process, who they were comparing us to, how they were doing that. She and her team and us at the board did a good job of just spelling that out.
Would it be fair to say that you could make these mechanistic arguments about the flaws in the way they calculated stuff, but the fundamental political argument about how much should these degrees cost, how much should international students be subsidizing, how much should the government be paying, et cetera, those more fundamental questions, were those pretty much left untouched?
No. So, like, again, we opened everything we did with the fact that we're opposed. We have a clear mandate from students to oppose, and it's what we need to make clear. We realized that if we were going to make a difference in the lives of these students who are going to be coming here and save them some money, we also had to, you know, and I don't like this expression, but speak the language of the board and show them where the flaws actually existed in the proposals that were coming forth. I really tried to work a little bit more diligently on the activism side of our opposition campaign. We saw that a bit through the Afford UBC campaign.
The Afford UBC campaign came about pretty late in the game. It was sort of after everything was over almost.
Mm-hmm. The timeline was a lot more condensed this year too than the increases that we faced previously. The Afford UBC campaign was a product of the Social Justice Center movements, or the motion, sorry, that they brought to council. So they had implored us to actually build a campaign that would then be publicly opposed. So it was a little bit late for sure, considering the time constraints, but we did get quite a lot of messaging out to students, which was nice. We did some advertising in media and online about how these increases were unjustified and the fact that, you know, this isn't really good for our university. It was a nice couple to the behind-the-scenes work we were doing with the proposals themselves, and at least stirred up some more attention on an issue that, frankly, I think for a lot of students has been hard to continue to be passionate about because of how long it's been exhausting them.
But I really think the thing that made the most difference was simply being in the boardroom there, you and Jenna speaking directly to the board and making your case. Because it was kind of weird to be in there where the administration was there saying, oh, it's fine, we took the students' comments seriously and took them into account. Mm. And then meanwhile, you and Jenna get up and basically make the point, we don't feel like we were actually heard.
Yeah.
And it just kind of shows the disconnect that the board has between the rest of the campus, where they get all their information from one source, the administration, who tells them everything's fine, when that might not be an accurate picture of what's going on.
Yeah, and I think that was super effective. But, you know, the other things, too, that I think contributed to it, you saw as the board members were walking in, right? That this wasn't us, but the people who, like, put the money on the ground and, you know, those words, those hopeful words that they kind of had to symbolically trot over as they went into the room. You know, like, the board members, as you mentioned, some of them maybe are more removed from the campus, and they don't necessarily get to see the everyday perspective of the modern student. Being able to actually walk past that kind of stuff, they are still human beings, right? So they do think about the stuff as they see it, and I think it did make...
They are still human
beings.
Yeah,
well, it's true. You know, they're just as...
Contrary to popular belief.
...as we are sometimes from them, and I think a lot of the times we forget that, but... they, you know, the letters that all these students came out and wrote, a lot of personalized handwritten letters to Martha Piper about why they think this is a bad idea, you know, that lies on people's decision-making capacity, and they do think about it. So it was the combo, I think, that really led to even that small budge in the administration's proposal.
The other thing that was interesting was that at the outset of these tuition increases, the administration said that the amounts were not negotiable and that the consultation was going to be about where is the money going to go. And then they ended up actually reducing the amounts. And also, it's a little strange that they wouldn't have had a plan for the money to begin with.
I think it showed in a lot of what we put forth a bit of a lack of leadership from the administration, where, you know, you would have Louise Cohen saying, no, this is a consultation on the numbers as well. Then you'd have Angie Reddish saying the exact opposite, right? And I think the board was kind of aware of that when push came to shove at the end, that there was a little bit of lack of thought put into this proposal, and I think it aided us in our argument and bolstering it.
So when you write your transition report for whoever happens to be the next AMS president, what do you put in about this as a lesson on how to influence the board?
The biggest lesson I'm going to give is the two-pronged approach. You need to appeal to people's empathy, and you need to appeal to pathos with some of those more activist, very passionate, very aggressive even sometimes campaigns that get students involved and make the board actually think. But the science is what's going to make the convincing argument at the table. And if you can really go head-to-head with the administration in a way that makes the board consider the fact that you have verifiable evidence and data to the contrary of what they're putting forth, I think that's where you're going to see results.
So on the topic of looking back, let's move on to something more light, I guess.
Cool.
What's the most fun you've had as AMS president?
Oh, man. That's hard to say because I'm hoping it's still coming, right? Homecoming was huge for me. As much as I was involved with it this year, I'm not a huge football buff. I don't really even know Canadian rules football that well, but seeing that many people come out on a sunny day and just enjoy themselves and for once demonstrate like a collective pride behind a university brand was interesting and quite enjoyable. A lot of just working with the executive team has
Oh, no, no, no. You can't say that working was the most fun of being president.
That's all I did, though, to be honest. The pit, you know, frankly speaking, I love pit night. I love seeing the community come together and celebrate in whatever way they see fit. I've really, really enjoyed just getting out there and being around people all the time. So, like, the Hotline Bling thing, even though Charles Menzies apparently isn't a huge fan of it, watching students...
He's not a fan of a lot of things.
Yeah, that's fair. He likes to run, though. But the Hotline Bling thing where people came out and just did something goofy that brought people together, that's the kind of stuff that I think I'll remember.
So last time when we talked to you, there was a funny clip that we foolishly ended up cutting, and we thought this could be an opportune time to bring it out of the vault.
Okay.
Maybe we should take a listen.
If council wants me to be the genitals, I will be council's genitals. Definitely use that as a soundbite. It's amazing. Nobody has asked me to be the genitals of council yet, so, you know, the offer still stands, so, you know. I'm at the whim of the student body.
On that note, thank you, Aaron Bailey, for coming in.
No worries. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Well, that's our show. I'm Mayanne Kreitzman, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM, and podcasting at ubcinsiders.podbean.com. You can follow us on Twitter at UBC Insiders, check out the blog, ubcinsiders.ca, or find us on Facebook. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, man. Next week, we'll be talking about UBC's approach to sexual assault policy with Sarah Jane Finley, the AVP at the head of the Equity Inclusion Office.
Can't wait. Insiders out.